Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Inside F1 with Joe Sayward. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanner, so let's be friends. Here on Missed Apex, we bring you a variety of voices: drivers, journalists, statisticians, presenters, and pundits. And king amongst them all, certainly in experience-wise, a person who has been to every single Grand Prix since 1988. It's the infamous Joe Sayward. How's it going, Joe?
Hello. Yes, all is well. I've just come back from Monza. Which was yesterday I got back. So, yes, everything's fine. I've been away from home for much of the last 3 weeks, going to Belgium and Holland and Italy. And now I'm having some time off because, thankfully, they cancelled the Russian Grand Prix and I don't have to do anything for 2 weeks, which is a real luxury.
Now, put your feet up. You live in France, but your experiences in the paddock mean that you're never alone. Is there anyone now where you think, oh, actually, I don't know them that well? Because there's a few new kids like Seidel and Jos Capito. Well, is it hard when new team managers come in as a journalist?
Yes, it is. But it's in the case of Capito, he was there 20 years ago, so I know him from that. Seidel, yes, he doesn't know me. He doesn't, you know, you've got to build up relationships, and that takes time. But in terms of the people in the paddock, there's been enormous changes since the pandemic. So there's huge numbers of people I don't know. And also we weren't allowed into the motorhome, so you'd get to meet fewer people. So There's lots and lots of people. It's quite disconcerting, actually, because, you know, after a while. And so you have to sort of go through the process of learning all new names and people.
Yeah, I know. I guess you've had to do that loads and loads of times because you've done it for such a long time.
I suppose so. But the sort of the lifetime members of Formula One, who I've been, you know, I've known for 30 odd years or more. You know, they are, the group is thinning out, but it's still a solid group and they're all in quite important jobs these days.
How much of them? Yeah. How much of the social aspect do you get involved in? Because I've only had one experience of being in the paddock club and there's lots of like F1 royalty and dignitaries and people who have like lifetime passes to the paddock. Do you ever get involved in any of that? Do you ever sup some champagne with the stars?
No. Not really.
Joe.
Occasionally. Well, we don't do much of that because we work a lot.
Oh, what a waste.
There is a big myth about people going on holiday and having parties all the time.
Yeah.
It's not like that at all. You know, I work. I never go out on Saturday nights or Sunday nights because I'm working on both. And Friday nights, Thursday nights, occasionally we'll have some fun. But it depends who's busy. I mean, everyone's busy. We're just busy at different things.
Yeah.
So, and when you do have sort of sponsor events, they're fairly well orchestrated, and usually the stars will pop in for like 3 minutes, say the right thing, and then leave because they don't want to spend their time hanging out with us, you know. So that's just the way it is. But, you know, what the value of being around a long time is you get to talk to people around the back of the motorhomes, and you whisper secrets to each other and you find out what's going on. So,
well, Chris Medlin said it was nonstop Jaeger bombs. So maybe you just don't get invited, Joe. Must be it.
Well, Chris Medland is a youngster, and he doesn't work as hard as I do. So, you know.
Shots fired. Shots fired. Okay, let's get straight into our listener mailbag. We've got some great questions, and the first one is from Ida Lozada, I beg your pardon, who says, my question to Joe is, Antonio Perez Grebe, Sergio Perez's dad, is promoting the organisation of a new Grand Prix in Mexico at Cancun. How realistic is the chances of said race, and which other countries and cities are looking to get into F1? Another destination Grand Prix, Joe?
Well, I mean, there's a theory that it might be a good idea. The race in Mexico City has got a new contract recently, so there won't be two races in Mexico because Sergio's not good enough for that. Sorry, Perez fans, but that's the reality of it. So if the Mexico City people don't want to do it, maybe we could go to Cancun, but it's a big ask, and it's a lot of organization to do. And if it's a street track, which it would be, you've got to get everyone to agree to, and it's taken Formula One many years to get Las Vegas sorted out. So Cancun might be a good idea. They also have more storms in Cancun, I seem to remember. Lots of sort of hurricanes and things coming in, which is never a good plan.
No.
But for the moment, there's no serious possibility, but maybe in 5 years' time. But I think in 5 years' time, Sergio probably won't be there anymore.
And no up-and-coming Mexican youngsters coming through the ranks?
Not that I've spotted, although there's a man called Villa Gomez, who I believe owns half of Mexico, and he crashes every other weekend in Formula 3. In fact, he crashes twice every weekend most of the time. But he does own a lot of Mexico, so he's jolly wealthy.
Ah.
So they tell me. I have not seen anything yet that makes me think he's going to be a megastar.
So but you're not...
Apart from crashing a lot.
So you're not optimistic like we were being at the weekend, that perhaps the dawn of the pay driver is kind of disappearing a little bit in F1 with the franchise model, that perhaps they wanted to kind of phase that out a bit?
No. Wealthy drivers have advantages. Wealthy drivers can go on crashing a lot and learning the way. And they can then, they have to earn their super license points, and that shouldn't be changed. We don't want people who are there because they've got money. Now, you can't negate the power of money, but you can mean you can have a situation where they have to be good enough to get through to a super license. Now, right now, Colton Herta hasn't got one. And everyone goes, oh, isn't it a shame? Well, I'm sorry, but Colton Herta hasn't done the results necessary. He finished 10th in the championship in IndyCar. You know, he may not be a driver god. I mean, there's a sort of tub-thumping crew out there somewhere who is saying that Colton Herta is the best thing since sliced bread. But, let's see the proof of it. And when we've got the proof of it, then he can have a super license because he'll earn it. But, you know, right now, Logan Sargeant, who is the American in Formula 2, is far closer to a super license. And apart from the fact he's had three bad weekends in a row, he looks pretty good.
That leads us really nicely onto our next question, actually, Joe, as if you're some kind of savant. Ken March has written in and says, I've greatly appreciated your journalism, Joe. I'm sure he means you, not me. For more seasons than I care to admit, I really enjoy these episodes with Spanners as well on the podcast. My understanding is that Aston Martin has just signed their very first junior driver, and I was surprised that they already didn't have a junior program. In the context of Alpine losing their top junior driver to McLaren, Helmut Marko looking outside to IndyCar, to Colton Herta, to potentially fill a seat. My question is, what's the general status of various F1 teams' junior programs? Stay well and kind regards from Ken March, a quiet patron, he says. That's a great question. What is the state of the junior programs?
Well, the Red Bull Junior program has got lots of drivers in it, and most of them seem to be messing up for different reasons. Yuri Vips got himself into all kinds of trouble for opening his mouth. The others are either too wild or not wild enough. We've got, I think there's four of them, maybe five in Formula 2 at the moment, all in the program. But they're either too young or too wild. Like Iwasa, the Japanese driver, is very good. He's in his first year, and he's impressed me. And, you know, the other question is there room for two Japanese drivers in the Red Bull program? So,
hang on, it's not a sitcom, Joe. You can have more than one of each.
No, you can't, because you've got four drives on offer in the whole world, in the Red Bull teams. You've got Red Bull Racing, and you have AlphaTauri. Now, you've already got one Japanese driver in one of the AlphaTauris. Are you going to have two Japanese drivers? And the answer is probably not. So that's a bit complicated. Anyway, there's also the Lawsons and Schmorsons and Blawsons and all these sort of, you know, people in the middle of the Red Bull program who haven't quite done enough. And also we've got, what's happened is we've got a whole bunch of new boys who've arrived, and some have proved themselves and some haven't. Now, Hauger has looked very good. He's a Red Bull driver, but he hasn't looked very good this year. So, you know, at the moment, they don't have an immediately obvious person to step in if they need one. Now, that's why they don't want to let Pierre Gasly go, because Pierre Gasly can step in. If Max Verstappen slips on a banana skin and breaks his leg, which is entirely possible. I don't know if he eats bananas or not, but whatever.
It's happened. Look at Schumacher, you know, he did the same thing, didn't he? And he broke his leg one season. It happens.
Look at Alex Albon last week.
Potentially,
you know, somebody steps in and replaces him.
Get well soon, Alex.
You know, they need to have somebody who's good enough to do that. And so Red Bull's got Pierre Gasly there until the end of next year in a position where he can do that. They don't want to let him go, because that would be a difficult thing to replace, because they don't. Tsunoda's very quick, but he's a bit all over the shop, isn't he?
Yeah, but it feels like we'd hear less of the erraticness of Tsunoda now, and we hear less about, oh, lack of discipline or bad radio calls. It does feel like he's kind of feet under the table a bit more, no? No.
He's still all over the place in races. But the thing is, he's quick, and that's important. Now, if he can get it all together, that's fine. Anyway, to go back to the question, we have the other young driver programs. Ferrari have ended up with losing most of their good blokes, or finding their good blokes aren't good enough, or finding their good blokes are Russian, which doesn't help. And so they're sort of stuck. Yeah. With Giovinazzi at the moment. He's about the only one left, I think, because Callum Ilott's in the US and Robert Schwarzman will get some chances for FP1s. But to be honest, there's no great instant replacement at Ferrari, because they seem to have lost interest in Mick Schumacher.
Nah, there's a question about Mick Schumacher on the way down. And as I find
I'm sure
it,
there is.
as I find it, I will just say that, like, I actually quite like Giovinazzi, but I don't think it's unfair to say that it feels like an uninspiring choice.
That's fair enough. But the point is, you don't necessarily, if you haven't got the latest new megastar, you don't necessarily want the latest new non-megastar and have to find out the hard way that he's not a megastar. You want to have somebody who you know is pretty much okay, but, you know, does the job. So these are the choices that team principals have to make. Anyway, go back to the other.
I will do,
Because we haven't finished the junior team thing.
No,
yet.
I know. And I'll just say, that's no disrespect to Giovinazzi. I think you go in, you probably know what you're getting, and he's going to do a job.
Yeah, pretty much.
Matthew Cottrell's question there, we'll divert slightly again, was what are Mick Schumacher's best chances of being on the grid in 2023? Is he still associated with the Ferrari Driver Academy? And if not, why, demands Matthew Cottrell.
Well, you have to ask Ferrari that question, but the answer is no, he's not. And his best chance of getting on the grid right now is probably Stefano Domenicali saying, we need a German. But nobody's going to listen to him, because we don't really need a German.
The Germans will watch F1 without a German driver.
The Germans aren't watching F1 anyway.
Really?
At the moment. It's because they turned it over to pay television, and they lost a huge number of viewers, as you do when you turn it over pay television. Yep. You make more money, and that reflects in all the financial results. Yeah. But you lose the number of the big numbers of people who used to be there.
Yeah, I'm crying in UK over that as well. Don't worry about it.
Well, everybody in every country in Europe, they're crying over it. It's just a move that's inevitable, probably, in the history of television, which is, you know, why should anything be free? Is a very sound argument. But it has been for years, and that's why people are upset about it. Younger generations seem to be more willing to pay for sport than the older generation. But the older generation is not the future of Formula One, is it?
I will say, I will happily pay for Formula One. So if the people of Formula One are listening before they do their next big TV deal, I object to having to buy a whole cable package just for the one channel I want. You can charge me pretty much anything you want all the way up to Sky TV prices, and I'll pay it. Just for your reference, F1 TV, if they give me a streaming over-the-top service, I'll bite their hand off for it, because that's the only thing I want cable for.
Yeah, but ultimately, if you look at the overall scheme of things, over-the-top streaming services are the future. They're the way to go. But you need to build up the audience, and you need to have people having a way to see what it's all about. Because if you don't know anything about racing, why on earth would you pay all that money? So sometimes it's good to have a few races that are live and free, which is why Channel 4 exists. It's basically to help feed Sky. And in Germany, RTL does 4 races to help feed Sky Germany. But, you know, ultimately, that's still got a middleman. If you take out the middleman with the F1 streaming service, at the moment they're using Sky commentary and all the rest of it to cut their overheads, I suppose. But if you can charge everybody in the world who watches Formula One £5 per race or whatever the number is, you start doing the numbers and the profits of Formula One go through the roof, absolutely double, treble, quadruple what they are today. And right now they're doing very well. So, but not necessarily from streaming, from other things as well. But along the way, that's a huge growth market that will happen one day.
Interesting take from Joe Saywood. Whisper Films are the gateway drug to Sky F1.
Yeah, that's about right.
Okay. If I had an up-and-coming young driver in my stable, how would I make them a junior driver? How does one get to be a Red Bull junior or a Ferrari junior?
Well, you can't make them. Red Bull comes to you and says, we want that kid.
Ah, and they do. And that, does that feel like a meritocracy?
That's what happens. It is a meritocracy. Within exceptions, it's a meritocracy. The exceptions are obviously things that would make me unpopular to say out loud, but, you know, sometimes they pick people for the wrong reasons. But if only to sort of tick boxes on quotas and things like that. But usually speaking, you go for the best drivers available.
And what sort of level? Because you're going to have to be wealthy enough to be spotted and for Red Bull to say, we want that kid. Where do you think I have to place my driver to be seen and picked up for a junior program?
International karting.
International karting. Really?
Oh, yeah. So, actually, you don't even have to be international karting. If you're really good and someone spots you in national karting, word will get out on you and you could be picked up. And if you look at the moment, Mercedes is always watching the karting world. McLaren's watching karting. Mm. Alpine, don't know, but probably. Mm. Now, all these people are watching the karting because that's where the new stars come from. Now, if you look at the cost of karting these days, it is kind of crazy.
Yes.
It's never been a cheap sport. But is it any different to horse riding? You know, if you want to be an Olympic dressage rider, you've got to have a horse that'll do dressage.
Yeah.
Well, some people do, but, having owned a dressage horse once in my life, I can tell you they're very expensive and they cost a fortune to feed.
Hmm.
And you have to chase them around when they escape as well, which is boring.
That's a great question from Ken. Thank you, Ken. You've led us down a merry path. I think I'll move on down the mailbag. Actually, someone in our patron Slack chat has just said, just to cheer up Uncle Joe, not that he needs cheering up, I've added the Green Notebook RSS feed to my reader. So thank you very much to Missed Apex. Of course, you do a blog called The Green Book. Is that right? Is that what you call it? The Green Book?
No, it's called. I do a regular article on my blog.
Green Notebook.
Called The Green Notebook, which The Green Notebook is
He confused me there. But it's the book you note things down in and turn into a blog. And I like it because it's a long read. It's a get lost in it read. It's very good journalism and also just a bit of a good story as well. There's the green notebook itself, everyone.
I'm running out. I need to get a new one.
So go and subscribe.
It's the notes, and I turn the notes into an article. And I usually have a little bit of a travelogue there to tell the world what it's all about as well.
Yeah, so,
that's on joebloggsf1.com.
I do feel like I'm transported a little bit into your world when you write those blogs. So that's good.
That's what you're supposed to be, yes.
Yeah, it's more than just here's the thing that happened today, which is what a lot of journalism is. And there's a place for that reporting, but Uncle Joe also does some storytelling as well. So let's get on with the questions from Gene Davis. He says, where does Mr. Saywood, very formal, with his long perspective on Formula One, placed this season by Max Verstappen and Red Bull among the dominant car driver performances that he has covered? Good question, Gene.
It's a pretty impressive one, although to be fair, Ferrari have kind of given it to... wish to make you choke on your coffee, but...
You're right, though.
And I know, yeah. That people down in Italy will complain about me saying it, but the fact is that Ferrari has a quick car and they've wasted it. Now, they don't have quite as quick a car in race trim as they do in qualifying, so let's qualify that. But they've made so many mistakes with strategies and pit stops, and it's just not been very good. And, Red Bull have benefited from that. It helps, obviously, that Mercedes produced a car that isn't really very good. Mm-hmm. And you've sort of got the means to... turn around the trends of recent years, mainly because Mercedes have not done the job.
That is interesting, because in previous dominant seasons, like say the very recent Mercedes domination, there wasn't the potential in the chasing cars to catch them until like 2017, 2018, where Ferrari had a shot. Here, you have two teams where Ferrari actually had a car to challenge. Mercedes definitely have the potential to pull out a challenging car, yet both teams fell short. But I don't think that diminishes the domination in any way, because Red Bull have been near perfect.
It does diminish the domination, because domination comes from having a bunch of poor rivals. Mm. So you can say in some years that when you're winning and you're beating the opposition and they're good, is obviously a stronger year than when you're beating the opposition and they're bad. So it is... And it changes all the time as well, you have to say, because the cycles of success and failure in Formula One are becoming longer as time goes by, because it's just such a much more complicated business. In the old days, you'd have a new sort of set of dominant people in 2 or 3 years, and you go up and down and up and down. But nowadays, it's sort of 5 to 6 years, which started with the Red Bull era, I suppose.
Yes, a Red Bull could have been dominating for 5 years. If they'd have picked up the 2009 championship, that you could have been looking back at a 5-year domination. The Mercedes one was definitely, I can imagine even the organizations and probably Mercedes themselves were feeling the fact that they were part of such a long dominating period from, they must have felt that internally as well.
Yes, no. I mean, the thing about Mercedes, which is remarkable, is that they have this consistent reinvention going on to make sure they don't get complacent. And yet, having said that, they haven't done the goods. They haven't delivered the goods this year. So it's just the way it is sometimes, and you just have to wait and see. But the best seasons are always in the changeovers between one dominant force and another dominant force, or maybe even sometimes three dominant forces that all come together. I mean, we've had some fantastic seasons in the past. My favorite, I think, being 1982, when there were something like 13 different winners from 6 or 7 teams, I suppose. And they were just all sort of sorting it all out.
Was that Rosberg? Rosberg Championship, 82?
He was a champion with one race victory.
Nice trivia knowledge from me there. Why didn't that question come up in the quiz, Catman? I would have known that one. I would have got that one, Joe. I would have got
you
that
would.
One.
You have to name the race as well, then I'll be impressed.
Spa?
No. Nope.
Took a punt. What was it?
It was a Swiss Grand Prix in Dijon that he won.
I didn't even remember that there was a Swiss Grand Prix, because I was only 1 year old.
But doesn't matter. You can read books.
That's true. read. I haven't read a book since Netflix got good. Let's move on to, thank you, Jean, for that question. Oh, a Dutch Grand Prix question here. This is from, I'm so apologies. I'll pick up who it's from in a second. But he says, being Dutch, I was at Zandvoort for 2 days. He said, my dad wasn't overly impressed. He's a seasoned F1 visitor, but it was madness out there. He had to wear earplugs, not because of the engine noise, but because of the music. Insane festivals meets football, meets King's Day party, cafes, and a tiny bit of racing. Is that the impression you got as well, Joe?
Yep. We were walking up and down the grid with this thumping disco music going on, and nobody could talk to each other. And it was like, why are they doing this? You know, half the grandstand were probably drunk anyway. And maybe they couldn't hear either. I don't know what it was, but there is a tendency towards sort of thumping disco music, which Formula One group seems to think is necessary at all occasions. And maybe it's because it's for a younger generation. I don't know, but maybe. I don't get the impression. The thing about the Dutch Grand Prix is, and this will probably upset some Dutch people, but what the hell, I have to say it anyway. About 20% of the Dutch fans are really racing fans, and 80% of them are success chasers, I think, because an awful lot of people have no clue about racing there. And, you know, I think that's part of the story. So they don't have any clue about racing. Therefore, they have no clue about how you behave at races, which is why you have all those flares going off all the time and, you know, this kind of stuff. And, but I think it's fair to say that because, you know, back in the day before there was Verstappen's success, the Dutch contingent of fans was still there, but they were much smaller.
I'd argue with you a lot more if our Netherlands iTunes review average rating wasn't hovering around 2.1. I'd probably argue a little bit more than that, Joe.
Well, I mean, it happens. There are only certain drivers who have armies of people who follow them. And Verstappen's army is the most mobile of all the followings I've ever seen. I mean, Mansell had his own little army of Red 5 followers, but none of them ever went to the French Grand Prix. Michael Schumacher had an army of campervan people with mullets and beer in one hand and a mullet sort of hanging off down their back. And they went to ones you could drive to in campervans.
Okay.
And Max's people will go everywhere in the world. It's amazing. So they don't have mullets, but a lot of them have beer in one hand. Yes.
To be clear, we've got loads of really, really nice Dutch Missed Apex fans. F1 fans that listen to Missed Apex that are also Patreon supporters and that are lovely to us and very, very knowledgeable about racing. But I think you're right.
They are certainly.
A newer kind of bandwagon of people enjoying the sport. You know, we can't gatekeep in what way you should enjoy the sport.
And we shouldn't gatekeep. It's like when we go to the States, we've got a whole new generation of fans and they all scream when they see a star. Teenage girls and middle-aged women. I mean, it's like the Beatles when you go over. Miami was just a complete zoo of these new fans, but I don't have a problem with that. Because grumpy old men are not going to keep the sport going. So it's good. It's good that we don't have just grumpy old men grunting as a star goes by, you know. But, you know, sometimes they get a little bit overexcited, some of these Americans.
So it was Baz that sent that email, but that wasn't actually the gist of his question. He's asserting, Joe. He says, F1 needs backmarkers as much as it needs front runners. I'm not saying I would like to go back to the times of pre-qualifying. I would. But wouldn't it be great to see 4 or even 6 extra cars? 26 seems fair to me. Young talent would then have the possibility to get racing miles.
What young talent has the possibility to get racing miles. And you don't need the extra cars because extra cars have all kinds of downsides to them as well, which is the teams go bust. You have to spread the money around between more people if you want them not to go bust. Right now we have 10 solid teams, all with good infrastructure. If we have 3 new ones, they're not going to be anything like as good as the ones there. And the chances are they won't survive. So, and as to whether or not young drivers get the chance, you now have these programs going on where they can drive thousands of kilometers in 1-year-old cars, which is fine. That works okay. So I don't see the need for it. You also have things like every racetrack would have to have more pit garages built. You'd have to have more emissions because flying all this stuff around the world would have 6 more cars. there's all kinds of elements to it where 20 is the right number. And I don't see the point in adding three more weak ones to that.
Well, it's just more F1 cars, Joe. I'm really disappointed.
More F1 cars get in the way when the fast ones are lapping as well. You know, cause races to be take out the leader when he's going past some useless tin box that's just sort of trundling down the middle of the road. So it's just silly.
Didn't mind seeing the battle between Marussia and Caterham and the drama of who would get that point and end up getting, you know, into that tier of the prize money. I thought that was all right, and there was good personalities.
You can have that with Williams. You know, it's the same thing. It's just you're looking for the perfect number, and the perfect number, I think, is 20. Because it's just easier to move 20 things around the world, and it's a good balance of everything. And if you're any good, you know, you'll move up the order. It's not about. It's good to have 20 solid teams. Sorry, 10 solid teams. We haven't had that in the past, and this is now a situation where nobody, you know, the last one who looked ridiculous, but it was because the owner was you know trying to stay out of jail and hadn't got any money to. And so he sold out, but nobody now is struggling to survive financially.
Okay, lawyer's happy. No names were mentioned. That's good. Okay, but...
Well, it's true today, and I'll say the name if you like.
No,
it's not that hard
we're getting I say, let's move on. There's so many questions. Thank you, Baz, for that. And also, Baz mentioned that Nick is not pronounced Nick. It's pronounced like Greek, so Nick. So we should be saying Nick de Vries.
Even on a budget... Quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ian Connell's got a question that's non-pronunciation related. It is safety car related. So just, I've said my piece on safety cars. I'm not going to say anything more, but I am going to read his question. I've got no great love for Formula E racing, but I do think the Formula E safety car policy is a good one. If the safety car is out for a number of laps, they extend the race distance by a number of laps, not necessarily all of it. Teams can then take the risk of how much extra fuel, or I guess in Formula E, yeah, that's not a consideration.
No, they run out of battery power. It's a daft idea, isn't it?
To carry out. Okay, so currently
they all break down because the safety car period was extended. That doesn't make any sense.
But Ian is pointing out that currently F1 cars don't run with full tanks, so there would be the capacity to carry extra fuel. Look, and this is all on the assumption that people don't want it to end under the safety car. I personally don't have a problem with that.
Nobody wants any race to end under a safety car. It's boring. Nobody wants that. Having said that, there are situations where it has to happen. And there is no justification for calling a red flag and sort of putting on something.
Playground garbage.
Well, it's just basically creating an artificial showdown, which NASCAR do that all the time. You know, let's throw a yellow for debris on the back straightaway. And then they pretend it's all, and they have a great finish, and everyone goes, gee, wasn't that exciting? But nobody says, well, actually, it's a load of old rubbish, because they just crunched all the cars together for the last couple of laps. It depends what you want in racing. You know, Formula One's all about, in theory, all about the purity of racing. I don't like the safety car rules as they are now, simply because the leader loses his advantage and the man behind gains I mean, I've been saying this ever since Abu Dhabi. The fault in Abu Dhabi was the safety car rules. It's not the way the race director behaved. This time, the race director followed.
Okay.
It was quite funny in Monza, because all the people who complained about, you know, the safety car should have done, or sorry, the race director should have done this in Abu Dhabi, weren't able to complain this time because they followed the rules, and it made it very dull.
Yeah, no, but I'd rather have the odd nil-nil than Abu Dhabi. But an interesting point with
Abu Dhabi, the fault is not in the race director. The fault is in the safety car.
Okay. I don't agree, but I'm not going
to
get into
it. I know, you don't have to agree, but I'm just saying that's my own take of it.
Okay.
And people don't agree with me, but that's my feeling. I don't like the safety car because it's unfair.
Virtual
safety car. I don't mind the virtual safety car.
No, I think I do have some agreement.
Except
with you there.
You can't trust the drivers to stay within the numbers. You know, they'll always try to find an advantage.
Interesting strategical thing, which is that Vettel's advantage in 2013 was so great that they would pull out a whole pit stop advantage. So they always had a pit stop advantage, and they were so dominant it didn't matter. Mercedes and Lewis Hamilton, say 2017, 2018, he would always just pull like 5 or 6 seconds ahead and leave himself that buffer. Now, I was always told the reason for that was if there was a safety car, you don't want to overuse your tires. So you saying the guy who's pulled out a big lead then loses all of that advantage, isn't it part of the modern F1 strategy to go, well, don't build up a massive lead, because you're using up tyres and there might be a safety car?
You can argue all kinds of where you like, but the fact is race car drivers go as fast as they consider it necessary to be. So who decides, you know, if they're going fast enough? Or, I mean, I like to think they're all going to the maximum. And to be honest, a lot of them are going to the maximum all the time. So. Mm.
Okay. Let's ask some team priority questions then. We've got two related questions from Brendan and from Phil. Let's start with Brendan's one. It seems like Perez has been underperforming lately in the Red Bull, with Mercedes having two number one drivers capable of beating each other. This leaves Red Bull vulnerable in the Constructors' Championship once Mercedes gets their car on pace, I'm assuming means next year. How much of a leash does Perez have if he keeps his recent performance before Red Bull gets someone like Lando for the second seat? Do they have a desire for two number ones? And then there's a related question with Mercedes. But, you know, what's your take on Red Bull? They seem happy with what they've got.
I don't think anyone's holding Sergio Perez back apart from Sergio Perez, to be honest.
So
he's underperforming rather a lot, I think. So
Red Bull must be unhappy then?
Not necessarily, because you don't want to upset the equilibrium of your number one driver. So having a bloke who's nearly there is fine. You don't need to have somebody who's definitely going to upset the apple cart. And Ferrari's getting into that territory of, you know, Charles is obviously a quick driver and ultimately the quicker of the two, but, you know, they've messed him around so much that, you know, Carlos is up there in the points fight. And, you know, you can create situations that are not healthy by doing that sort of stuff. So while it's great to say, yes, we've got two number one drivers, the reality is always that it's best not to have two number one drivers, because you end up with them slaughtering each other.
Yeah, I would never have two number ones.
But that's in the ultimately pragmatic arguments, you know, in the romantic fan approach of always having, you know, two drivers in the same car battling for glory. That's great. But at the end of the day, you've got to take into account the commercial realities as well, which is you don't want your two drivers colliding and somebody else going through to win.
What about if you have this a cap on the money you can spend during the course of the race? Presumably that includes upgrades as well. If I was a team boss, I would give all the upgrades to my number one driver, and halfway through the season, you would just stop giving them to your number two.
Yes and no, but, you know, I don't think it's good to have a demotivated second driver either. So You've got to keep people hungry. You've got to keep people excited. So I think the best thing is to give them all the same as much as possible and let them sort it out among themselves. So, but one has to be pragmatic about these things. So a lot of these arguments about budget cap are put forward by people who just want to find any which way to increase the amount of money they're allowed to spend because they've got the money. So that's enough. We'll talk about Christian Horner. You know, fundamentally, he'll always be arguing, although he pretends not to, he'll always be arguing in favor of having more money because he has more money. He has endless money to spend.
Limitless money. So, yeah. So the budget cap is specifically aimed at teams like Red Bull and Mercedes. Has it had an impact?
And Ferrari as well. Yeah, of course it's had an impact because they've had to slim down and do stuff. But, you know, it is... We'll see if it ultimately makes any difference over time. We'll see if it helps Alpine climb closer up next year, you know. Because you've also got to... It's not just about money. You've also got to use your money in a sensible way. You can be a multi-billionaire. Let's not name names. You can be a multi-billionaire who has a racing team. And it can be a complete disaster if you hire the wrong people.
Mm. Come on. We all know. Okay. You're talking about Aston Martin, Joe.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
There are several of them at the moment who fit that criteria. So,
yeah. Were you surprised, Joe? Were you surprised at the hiring of Alonso? Because that sounds like a match made in hell, honestly. I cannot see any way that works out.
It is a match made in hell, which is why Felipe Drukovic is a clever man. Because he's got a reserve drive with the team that will implode one way or the other.
F3
so he's
champion,
virtually yeah. guaranteed himself... He's virtually guaranteed himself a race drive within a year or two by being in the right place at the right time, just being able to watch this conflagration happen. Why did Teflonzo, whatever he's called, why did he do it? Well, because ultimately it's not about money. It's about respect. And he didn't feel that Alpine was being respectful enough for a man of his extraordinary achievement, brackets, two world championships when it should have been five. But you know, they were only willing to offer him a little bit of what he wanted. And so somebody who offered him the whole lot of what he wanted, he'd just go and drive for them. But is he going to win the world championship? Is he going to win races with Aston Martin?
What if he's really good? And I think he's probably really good still. Like,
But if your car's no good, it doesn't matter if you're really good because it'll be like, you know, driving Noddy's car at the back of a Grand Prix, won't it?
Yeah, but what if, like, he's just making Lance look, like, fully ordinary? Surely that's against the aims of Project Stroll.
Yes. Which is why it's daft. Unless, of course, you know, Danny Stroll is really secretly plotting against his own son, which isn't... It's all rubbish,
or he
isn't it?
Just has a lot of belief in his son.
He believes that his son is a world champion, and it seems like nobody can convince him otherwise at the moment. However, I have a vague suspicion that Fernando Alonso might be able to convince him of this because Fernando Alonso is, you know, proper old school racing driver of the highest order. And the first time that Lance Stroll beats Fernando Alonso, you can bet he's going to start grumbling in the corner about Lance having better equipment and blowing the team up because that's what Fernando does best.
Amazing.
Fernando is a team destroyer.
Let's get off the fence, Joe. Please. Please. He's wasting everyone's time being all neutral. We've got a question that follows on the Perez one from Phil McWilliam. Thank you for writing in, Phil. Can you ask our favourite F1 journalist, that's you, Joe, if he thinks Mercedes have shot themselves in the foot by signing George Russell? If they produce a winning car next year capable of fighting, George is so close, or dare I say, just as good as Lewis, that they'll take too many points off each other, which will play into the hands of the others. Keep up the good work. Kind regards from Phil.
Yes, that's entirely possible. But that's what proper racing teams do. Williams lost the world championship back in the 1980s by having Mansell and Piquet fighting one another, and Alain Prost nipped through the middle and won the championship.
2007.
That's the price you pay for...
Yeah.
You what?
Sorry, we've got a slight lag, Joe. I'm not meaning to interrupt you. 2007 as well. With
no,
the
I was... Well, yeah, I was going to say 1987 or 6 or whatever year it was. I can't even remember, but it's one of those... You know, the fact is that if you allow your two drivers to race one another, you are opening up the way for somebody else to go between him and win. And, you know, this is what Ferrari, under the efficient Mr. Todd, achieved. They had a clear number two driver and pretended they didn't until it became obvious they did. And Michael Schumacher, and he was there to win. So, you know, I don't think that's as sporting as having two number one drivers fighting each other. But, you know, Mr. Todd had a history of that in Peugeot on the Paris-Dakar. He tossed a coin to decide who was going to win the rally. So, you know, and when I shouted at him and said it was unfair, he said, my job is to make sure we are the most successful possible, and that's what I'm going to do it, which is a perfectly understandable, I wouldn't say justifiable, but it is, from a corporate point of view, that's the right answer.
You yelled at John Todt.
Oh, many times I've yelled at John Todt. And he's yelled back, to be fair. But, you know, we've had a few good fights. But our first fight was on the Paris-Dakar rally over the tossing of the coin.
Excellent. We've got some more questions for you, Joe. Hi, Uncle Joe, says Ivan. What do you think is the general opinion sentiment from the other team principals regarding the whole Alpine, McLaren, Piastri situation, particularly, and I'm glad you said this, Ivan, particularly on the loyalty aspect and how this will affect junior academies going forward? Alpine went really strong on the he should have been more loyal aspect of stuff. Like, they really, like, no shame, yeah, bridges burned.
But that's the only defence they had. You know, what they should have gone strong on is, well, if we'd made a decision, it wouldn't have lost both of them. You know, if we decided between one or the other before we did, then we would have kept one or the other. In the end, they lost both. So, to be honest, it's all a bunch of romanticism, you know, loyalty. Mm. If you look at the great racing drivers of recent generations, name one who didn't break a contract. The answer is Sebastian Vettel, I suppose. But before then, Schumacher walked out on Jordan. Senna walked out on Tolman. Prost walked out on McLaren. They all broke contracts to get into a car. The only difference is that Piastri hasn't raced a Formula One car yet, where the others had.
Yeah.
And that tells you the way of which Piastri is viewed by lots of people, that he's actually broken a contract before he's raced. I think that, to be fair to him, yes, it's not necessarily good for your image to do it, but you feel it's necessary to do it. And that is because the team is not behaving in a way that you feel comfortable with.
Do you reckon Piastri's management and agents and everything kind of took it all a little bit, maybe personally, that they were getting shunned, getting pushed to the side, getting palmed off on a Williams?
No, I don't think that's true. I didn't know what it meant at the time, but I sensed that the relationship was going wrong before it all blew up.
Oh, no.
I just sensed that things weren't, just from things that people said along the way and the way of, you know, the team was reacting with one another, I sensed that there was a sort of level of, Piastri didn't know where he stood. Alonso didn't know where he stood. And that is bad. If you don't know where you stand, then you start thinking about, well, what happens if? And if you start thinking about what happens if, then you say, well, I want to protect myself about what happens if, so I'll go find something else to do. And that's what happened. And, you know, it's brutal. But it's also, at the same time, you can understand it because, you know, what would happen if Fernando Alonso is signed for Alpine for one more year and Piastri gets to sit out a second year? Well, that's disastrous for a driver.
Mm.
You can't afford to have that. And that's why they never signed a contract to do that, because they were never going to sign a contract to do that. What they signed was a heads of agreement.
I don't know what that means.
It means an agreement that we will discuss an agreement.
Right. I'm with you. Okay. So what's happening is happening. He'll be lining up against Lando Norris. I don't know anything about Piastri. Is he gonna farewell against Norris by mid-season, by the summer break? Is he looking like he's on par?
Don't know. Because I think mentally, his mental strength is extraordinary for a man his age. Piastri is a remarkable. I mean, it's all about success. Is all about your mental attitude, and you can't afford to fall apart. So far, Lando's had it relatively easy at McLaren, but we'll have to see how it comes out in the end. I mean, Daniel Ricciardo has been all over the place and nobody can understand why. And the answer has to be in his head.
Joe, we are losing connection as the clouds drift over your rural surroundings because you live on a vast estate in a woodland surrounded by deer and horses, which isn't always the most conducive for amazing broadband. So before we lose you, let's make sure that people know where to follow you, at Joe Sayward on Twitter, and you do a bunch of other things like your blog, and you run a magazine called GP Plus Magazine, which is hand-carved on a wax tablet and delivered on a gold cushion to everybody personally.
Well, it is actually a PDF. It's not paper. You know, we're not chopping down trees to make it happen. But you can get the whole story of a race weekend 6 hours after the race ends, and it's brilliant. Even though, you know, I say that obviously I'm biased, but it is. Nobody else has ever achieved doing it. Nobody else has even tried to do it because it's almost impossible to do. But we do it every race. So,
well, Chris Medland said it's more important to be right than first. And there's you just rushing them out, Joe.
Yeah, but we're right and first.
Okay, that's good. I'm going to try that tactic on Miss Apex. I'm going to go, listen to us. We're brilliant. I'm just going to flat out say it. I like it. I've learned from you there, Joe. Anyway, go and follow Joe at Joe Sayward. We're going to put the links in the show notes to all of his stuff. We're going to hook up a live audience with Joe where you can jump on a Zoom call and ask him questions in person and hang out for a small fee. And we're going to do that an evening in the near future as well to emulate the live audiences that Joe does. Joe, when's your next live audience where we can actually go and see you in person?
That's a very good question. At the moment, it will probably be the end of the season, because one of the hardest things is to find a venue that's willing to accept a sensible amount of money. They all want far too much, and it becomes impossible to do.
It's a shame. So, they're good. They're fun, those.
Yeah, I know they're great fun to do as well, and I enjoy them, but the venues are greedy. And Formula One is living in a very greedy world at the moment, where everywhere we go, and we're seeing it with airline prices, car hire prices, hotel prices, everything's off the clock everywhere. So if you try and rent a venue at a race these days, they want more money than you're actually going to make. So it just doesn't make any sense to do it.
Charge triple.
As much as you'd like to do it.
Nobody
will come if you charge triple, because the tickets cost too much money as well.
Your internet snapped back into life. So I'll just see if we can field this last one from Jasper, which says, why is Ferrari maintaining Binotto? This season is obviously his responsibility.
Well, that's an interesting question, and one that has been asked up and down the paddock. And the answer is probably because they haven't gotten any options that I can think of.
But they must not be happy, or do they think he's the man to turn it around?
Well, John Elkann, who is the president of Ferrari and of Fiat, or whatever it's called this week, Stellantis, he seems to have a rather naively, which is odd talking about their boss of two car companies, isn't it? But he does seem to have a sort of naive view that Binotto is the savior of mankind, which he's possibly the only person who thinks that way. However, he's the boss, so it's his company, it's his money, ultimately, large chunks of it, because he owns a big share in the company, and he makes the choices. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't agree with them, but you know, it's all very well saying get rid of Binotto. You have to find out somebody to sort of go sit at his desk who will do the job better. That's a tough call, because if you hire somebody from outside who doesn't speak Italian, you create problems.
That's true, but that's not a very ringing endorsement for the squad depth at Ferrari, though, Joe. You don't see there's an obvious person there that would step up if Binotto just decided to retire?
Nope.
Oh.
Nope, I don't see anybody there at all.
Well, on that damning note, go and follow Joe. Click all the links below. Go and follow him on Twitter, and keep in touch and keep an eye out for the next time you can have a live or virtual audience with Joe Sayward. You've been listening to Missed Apex podcast. We will be trying to do a mega panel phone-in over the course of the weekend, and we'll certainly have some content for you before the Singapore Grand Prix as well. That's a late night race. We will do our race review that night, though. So we will watch the race. We'll have an hour to get our affairs in order, and then we will review it straight after the race. Because, as we know, it is more important to be first than it is to be right. But wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.